Hello and welcome to Bread and Rosaries, a podcast about the UK, Christianity and the left. I'm Ben Molyneux-Hetherington, my pronouns are he, him, and I'm joined, as always, by Adam Spears, whose pronouns are also he, him. Adam might be a little under the weather today because he has spent the day praying for our beleaguered police officers. Hello, Adam. Have you been on your knees in fervent prayer all day long?
You were working on that one for a while, were you? We should pray for our beleaguered police officers. I'm not necessarily sure we should pray in the ways that people might expect us to pray for police officers.
Are we praying that they might know the fruits of repentance?
I have to be very careful about what I say at this point, but essentially, yes.
As that introduction may have made clear, today we're going to be talking a bit about some of the protests that have been happening up and down the UK and the policing of said protests. So what we want to do is kind of catch up with where we are in terms of the protests that have been going on around the country. But there are other people better placed to give you a kind of a guide on the ground and some reflection and analysis more generally about the protests that have been going on and the policing of those protests and all that sort of thing. So what we're going to try and focus on is talking about Christianity and the church's relationship to protest and the policing of protests and, you know, the both the good, the bad, and the hope for the future that we might find within that. So that's where we're kind of heading. But to start with, let's kind of catch up with where we are. So it is Saturday, the 3rd of April, Easter Saturday. So only a few days before this will come out. We talked on the last episode about the protests that came out of the Sarah Everard murders. They have mostly finished now, but I think the story of what we're seeing over the last few weeks in the UK kind of starts with them. So for a brief catch-up, Sarah Everard was a young woman who was murdered on her way home when she was on her own. Eventually, it came out that the police had arrested a Metropolitan Police officer and he has been charged with the murder. Obviously, at this point, it is impossible to say with any certainty if he did in fact commit it, but it is extremely unlikely that a police officer would be arrested for a crime without some fairly strong evidence that that is what has happened. As a result of this, protests were set up, organised by women to campaign and protest male violence in a way that was, I think quite uplifting in some ways, even if it was, you know, perhaps not always as nuanced as we might like it to be. Particularly an organisation called Reclaim the Streets organised a large protest in London a couple of weeks ago. However, after having a conversation with the police, an ongoing conversation, and despite the fact that the High Court in this country ruled that protest was not off the table, even with the COVID laws that have been passed, Reclaim the Streets decided to officially cancel the big protest that had been organised and move it to a virtual space. However, it's pretty clear even at this point that people were going to continue to protest. It was already a big movement, and an organisation called Sisters Uncut took over the organising of the protests and tried to look after people. What happened in those protests, as we covered in last time, was essentially that the women were allowed to wait around until it got dark, and then the police moved in and were quite aggressive towards them, arrested a number of people. Generally, it was quite an unpleasant situation, particularly given that this was a woman who had been murdered by a police officer after dark. That kind of brought a lot of these things to people's attention. And there was a very strange thing going on where Reclaim the Streets, which is a fundamentally more liberal organisation, kind of tried to reclaim their centrality in all this, despite the fact they'd officially pulled out of the protests and were kind of trying to overwrite a little bit of the narrative around Sisters Uncut and the way that they actually, being a more radical and leftist organisation, kind of took over the running and did their best to try and look after people in these protests. Things have mostly kind of petered out. There are other protests around the country, but that, I think, is kind of mostly where we're at. Anything to add, Adam?
Only to say that the group is actually called Reclaim These Streets rather than Reclaim The Streets.
You are absolutely correct. It's in my notes correctly. I just can't read. So you had a bit of a narrative that does kind of recur and that we'll pick up in a little bit, which is about fundamentally more liberal organizations kind of coming into some conflict with these more radical organizations when it comes to the approach to protesting, to the relationship with the police and the state, and generally about how these things can be managed. I think also worth noting is that there are a number of people that were kind of pushed forward as figureheads by Reclaim These Streets, whereas Sisters Uncut is a lot more of a flat organization and doesn't look to kind of promote people as figureheads, celebrities, or, you know, representatives of that community. So there's some conflict there as well. So that's one aspect of it. And then bubbling alongside this is the new Police and Crime Bill. Adam, talk to me. Why is the Police and Crime Bill not such a great idea?
So what we've seen over the last 40 years or so is a gradual ebbing away of our rights as protesters, citizens, I suppose you might say, where more and more kind of draconian powers and policies are being brought in to enable the police to make things very difficult for you when you want to protest or take direct action or whatever it is. The new bill seeks to reinforce that in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. It's making it far more difficult. So the really big thing that it's doing is that it is essentially criminalizing protest. And what I mean by that is it reclassifies what counts as a protest. So now, you know, if one person turns up and wants to say something, that's a protest. Doesn't really matter what they're saying. But it also means that the police can decide on the spot that if what you're doing is causing a disturbance, if it's too noisy, if it's offensive. And key to this is actually not offensive, but has, you know, it could be deemed to be offensive to one person, even if there's no one around, right? That it immediately becomes illegal. And if you refuse to move on when asked to, you risk arrest and a huge fine. I think it's about £2,500. So that's at a fairly basic, fundamental level. But there are a lot of things that have been packed into this bill. One of the things that has received a bit more attention now is the fact that if you do anything to a statue, if you graffiti it or if you remove it, anything like that, you would face a maximum of 10 years in prison. The thing that this is being compared to is the fact that a lot of, whilst the maximum sentence for rapes and sexual assaults is greater than 10 years, I think it's actually life, the majority of people don't serve that. Even for the most violent of those crimes, most people serve about 6 years. And I know or have known people for whom that is true. So, yeah, the potential to serve 10 years for removing a statue should be something I think that scares us all. And obviously this is in response to the removal of the Colston statue in Bristol.
Well, we will talk about Bristol some more in a moment, because Bristol has become very much a locus for what's been going on. The other thing that I think is worth noting about this bill is that it essentially criminalises the Gypsy, Roma, yep, and Traveller way of life.
Yep.
A quick note for people who are maybe concerned when they heard me use the word Gypsy there. In other countries, I believe Gypsy is considered a slur. In the UK, it is the proper name for the community. The community themselves use that name, Gypsy. So Gypsy, Roma, Traveller, or GRT community is the proper language to be used about them. So do not fear, it is not a slur. So yeah, this bill is a direct attack, as actually, you know, officially announced in the Conservative manifesto on the GRT way of life. I don't particularly want to go into the details of that. There are other people that are better equipped to do that, but it is essentially a really nasty piece of anti-traveller legislation that is designed to stir up racial, ethnic hatred against traveller communities.
Yeah, and I think it's worth also very quickly mentioning that when you talk about racial and ethnic tensions being stirred up against the GRT communities, people often can't quite work out how racism is an appropriate term to talk about this, because people don't realize that the GRT community is a racialized community. And we should probably talk about racialization at some point, or get someone on to talk us through that. But very quickly, for now, these communities are communities that are racialized as essentially non-white, right? They're coded as non-white, even though, you know, you might look at someone from that community and think that they were white. What do we know about the way racism works? It's that actually racism is a social construct, right? And that's not to say that particularly the black community don't face really, really significant problems. Of course they do. But actually there's the particular problems that gypsies, Roma and traveler communities face are tied up in the fact that people don't think or don't realize that the prejudice that these communities face is racist.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you'd expect for a bill of this sheer unpleasantness, there have been a number of campaigns against it, and in particular, protests under the name #KillTheBill. A notable protest happened last weekend now in Bristol, where a large-scale protest against the bill took place. Adam, do you want to talk us a little bit what went down there?
Yeah, so there was a what started out as a peaceful protest to, you know, as described by all onlookers, really, as it drew on a little bit, tensions rose. Now, one account that I read said that initially the police were going around telling people that what they were doing was illegal, they couldn't gather, so on and so forth. But as more people joined, they stepped back and didn't take as direct an approach. But then as the evening drew in, as I say, there are conflicting reports on this, but certainly I would think a majority of reports say that the police goaded and, essentially provoked protesters into direct confrontations, and they became what have been described as riots. I think it's really important to say at this point that, you know, I've seen other, even sort of broadly left-wing outlets or organizations say, well, there are two sides to this story. Let's talk to someone who thinks that the police, you know, weren't all that bad, not naming any names. if you've ever been to a protest, yeah, right, and you think that the police don't behave in this way, you are living in cloud cuckoo land, and you must have been a very nice, peaceful protest with lots of flowers and hymns, yeah, or something. I don't know. Hymns is probably the wrong word. Lots of very, very radical Christians. So I retract that. But but the point is, if you don't think that they often, in fact, behave in this way,
yeah,
you're wrong. No two ways about it.
And there is video footage of you know, them, the police assaulting people, hitting them with the base of riot shields, attacking protesters with batons.
When they're sat down, when the protesters are sat down.
Yeah, sat down saying peaceful protest and being attacked by policemen with batons. We have seen stories of independent onlookers, first aiders, and even journalists being assaulted by the police, which is, you know, by a long-standing custom, people are... You know, if they are not in the thick of things, but if journalists and first aiders and independent onlookers are there, the police have always agreed to leave them be because they're an important part of kind of keeping everyone safe and keeping, you know, something approaching democracy in this country alive. And as you say, Adam, you know, you just need to know your history. There's a really good documentary on BBC iPlayer right now about British Black Power. And in that, you know, you could copy and paste the script for the, you know, the segment where they're talking about the policing of the mangrove protests that ended in a quote unquote riot and apply it to Bristol today. It's exactly the same tactics. Heavy handing policing leading to confrontation, leading to violence. You know, you look at the history of the LGBTQ movement in this country, and yeah, you've got the police assaulting LGBTQ inclusion protests. You know, you've got the history of the student protests, the student fee protests that also ended in violence because of policing. You have the Tottenham riots that occurred after there was a community gathering because someone had, a black person had died in police custody again, and they were there to protest that, and that ended in riots that were again seemingly provoked by the police. So if you think that the police don't provoke these things, you have no knowledge of your own history in this country. This is a really tired story that we've heard again and again. There's a couple of things I want to kind of touch on, one of which is the, you know, the way in which liberals and the liberal media in particular have responded to this. And again, this is, you know, drawing back, represented in some ways by that Reclaim These Streets movement. Liberals have broadly opposed this bill. It is such an obviously draconian and anti-democratic bill that even the most melted liberal has enough of what used to be their spine left to oppose this bill. But they're not actually prepared to do anything that might lead to the bill not passing. They're not actually prepared to oppose it in any meaningful way.
Yeah, and I think the most obvious way to point this out is that Theresa May was lauded by many for the speech that she gave against this bill in Parliament, obviously against her own government. She's now a backbencher. So everyone said, oh, this is a wonderful speech where she's criticising this bill and saying we shouldn't do it. And then she went and voted for it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's you know, the archetypal kind of liberal approach.
And we've seen plenty of liberal media figures, liberal politicians, basically condemning the protests, which are frankly the only way that we've got a chance in hell of stopping this bill passing. Liberals want us to write strongly worded letters to our members of parliament who can have fun using them as fuel for their fire, but don't want us to actually do anything to stop these changes happening.
Yeah, and also, you know, as is so often the way, we saw, in fact, I think in the last few days, we've seen the chief of Avon and Somerset police saying that actually the reports, because of the Avon and Somerset police after this said that lots of police officers were injured, including two that had broken bones, right? Yeah. And it's just come out in the last day or two in an interview from the chief of that police force that's not the case at all, and he says that they should have been a lot quicker to say that. But of course we see this all the time whenever something like this happens.
Yeah,
there are lies, half-truths, and just, you know, misinformation peddled to discredit protesters and people taking direct action to make it look like they're the most violent ones there, when actually we know that almost every single time it's the police that are the cause and the initiators of that violence.
Yeah, and we see it again and again that the police claim that officers have been injured, attacked, all this sort of thing. And then, you know, there's a really famous example, I can't remember where it's from, but the article was doing the rounds where the list of injuries turned out to be hay fever, stomach ache and headache. Like, you know, nothing at all to do with what was happening in the policing. But it, the story was put about that the police were violently attacked and had all these injuries, and it turned out just not to be true. So yeah, it's not a surprise that they've done this again and lied about having injuries that there was absolutely no evidence for. And you know, you mentioned this, I think, but this has been a great week for the British state marking its own homework, because merely a day after a report came out in which it basically said, Britain, not racist, no issues of racism in this country, the British state then put out a report saying, actually, all the police forces have done a really good job, and despite all the things you might have heard, actually they did as brilliantly as you could possibly ask, and it was all those nasty protesters that are the problem. A report written by, you'll be unsurprised to hear, police forces. So, an idea I want to kind of introduce at this point is the idea of manufacturing consent. And this is the way in which the structures of our society, particularly the media, present us with certain information and influence us so that we think we are consent to being ruled by the people who are in charge. So the consent for letting these people continue to boss us about and look after our society is manufactured by these same people through the various media organs and other cultural institutions. It's an idea kind of put about originally by Noam Chomsky, quite a famous anarchist thinker. And yeah, it's really important to understand these things, because the media kind of reported first of all in fits and starts, and then they were reporting the police's line, as we talked about, which turned out to be untrue. And it was only after sustained pressure that first of all, the majority of media organisations even mentioned what the protests were about. And then as more and more social media videos and reports were coming to light, and it became harder and harder to ignore the truth of what's happened, the media then slowly admitted that maybe the policing hadn't been perfect and that maybe there was more sides to the story. Is that a fair summary, Adam?
Yeah, and I think it's important to say, you know, that when they do that, the truth, if they're forced to admit it, comes out later, which means that actually the key points that, you know, the main reason that they would lie in the first place is largely just upheld. It's already in the public consciousness, and the retraction doesn't really matter. And I think a really good way to see this is, if you remember a few years ago when Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the Labour Party, there was some footage released of him failing to find a seat on a train, on a very crowded train. And he put out a short video saying, you know, we need to change the way we do trains, blah, 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 I can't get a seat. And then the train company, I think it was Richard Branson himself, owner of at the time of Virgin Trains, put out some CCTV video, a clip of some CCTV video, where he basically claimed that Jeremy Corbyn had been lying about that. And of course, it caused a huge uproar. Jeremy Corbyn's a liar, blah, blah, blah. And then it came out later that I think it was a Freedom of Information request, that actually that CCTV footage had been doctored to make it look like Jeremy Corbyn had lied, when in actual fact he hadn't, by which time the damage is done. And I know the damage is done because I've spoken to multiple people who lost faith in Jeremy Corbyn on that basis alone. And that's how this always works.
The classic example that is often gone to is Jean-Charles de Menzies, who was murdered in the aftermath of the London Tube attacks, where he was in a tube station and he was killed by the Metropolitan Police. And the majority of people still believe that he jumped the ticket barrier, which was a report put out by the Metropolitan Police that was subsequently proved to be completely false. But the vast majority of people still believe that he jumped the ticket barrier and still, to some extent, blame him for his own death, when in fact that was just the Metropolitan Police lying, and those lies were amplified by the media.
Manufacturing Consent was obviously a really, really important book when it came out in the 80s. But actually, a lot of the work that it did was building on the idea of cultural hegemony by Antonio Gramsci in the 30s, I think, in his prison notebooks. And I think it's, I know that's a sort of a really weird kind of nerdy thing to sort of say, but I actually really think it's important to...
Yeah, this is an idea that's almost 100 years old. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And people need to know what cultural hegemony is, because it's a really important idea.
So, yeah, we've seen a lot of this manufacturing of consent. And I want to kind of pivot us now to talk about the ways in which the British church continues to uphold this manufacturing of consent. So the church in the UK legitimates and sanctions and even sanctifies violence from the state. That is a big claim, but it is one that is true, and it is one that we're going to explore a little bit now. It's worth saying that Adam and I both come from an abolitionist perspective. In short, an abolitionist perspective is one that looks to the eventual point at which society no longer has police or prisons. This is obviously quite a radical idea, and one that we might in a future episode drop into in more depth. But as an abolitionist, you look to work towards that future in the way you support policies and approaches towards crime. So we come from that radical perspective, and that is inevitably going to colour what we talk about. So we are not looking for liberal reform. We don't want to change the police to be fluffier and nicer. Ultimately, we want to remove the police and prisons from our society, and therefore we're going to support approaches that move us towards that point rather than simply uphold the police but in trying to make them a little bit better. So as abolitionists, one thing you talk about is carceral logic. So if you think about, you know, we talk about people in prison being incarcerated, and the carceral kind of comes from there. And we have a state that is a carceral state. So it's based, you know, around a fundamental logic of imprisoning people, of taking people out of society. And that logic, the carceral logic, really infects so much of what goes on in society. The idea that punishment and removal of people is the appropriate response to things is a logic that underpins so much of culture and thought and society, and it also underpins a lot of theology. And I think, you know, we have to talk about this in a, to get Marxist on you, a dialectical way, in that there is not an A to B relationship going on here. It is that carceral logic infects and affects our theology, while simultaneously our theology upholds carceral logic and a society based on prisons and police at the same time. But I think we see this most clearly, and as we're talking about this on Easter weekend, it seems appropriate when we look at theologies of what happened at the cross. And at the root of a lot of theologies of the cross is a really clear idea that if there is sin, it must be punished. Our idea of justice is so strongly shaped with the idea of punishment. That is the key aspect of it. And yes, ultimately, we'd say, well, we don't get punished, but the punishment has to happen. And I think, you know, any theology of the cross that revolves around Jesus taking on the rightful punishment that is due to us as sinners is so clearly an example of that carceral logic at play. You know, there has to be punishment. Our need fundamentally as humans is for a justice that revolves around someone getting hurt, essentially, for the bad things that happen. And that is not actually a logic that I think is good. I would want to shy away from any theology of the cross that revolves around punishment and causing pain as a response to sin.
Jesus weeps for Gaza. He sees the pain and suffering of the 1.9 million people who have been forced to leave their homes without access to nutritious food, clean water, decent shelter. He hears the cries of the 25,000 orphaned children. He is with all who mourn the 250 people killed every single day. Christians for Palestine UK is a group of Christians who are calling for an immediate ceasefire in Palestine. We don't pretend to have all the answers, but are united in our prayers, hope and action for equality, peace and justice for all the peoples of the Holy Land. Together, we are organising a Christian presence at the National Marches for Palestine and local Days of Action, where we've been joined by siblings from Sabeel Kairos, Pax Christi and a whole range of Christian churches. We urge you to join us to act in solidarity with the people of Palestine and call for a permanent ceasefire and just peace. The Very Reverend Canon Richard Sewell, Dean of St George's College in Jerusalem, says, "I warmly welcome the newly formed group, Christians for Palestine UK. Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank need to see the solidarity of Christians in the UK, and they will be encouraged to see your commitment to stand up for them in their time of terrible suffering." To find details of local actions or to join the Christian bloc at a national march, follow Christians for Palestine UK on Instagram and Facebook, or email christiansforpalestineuk@gmail.com. Join us as we call for a ceasefire now.
Yep. I've got nothing else to add there. Agreed.
But I think that kind of underpinning logic, it is not just about that being a bad theology in itself, but that particular form of thinking, it primes us as Christians to think about things in a certain way. That means that when we get to thinking about justice broader in society, that our understanding of justice already centres punishment and violence and pain as part of what it means to do justice. So I think that's a really vital way in which our theology and the church kind of supports police violence. And the other thing that I want to talk about a little bit is about these ideas of like forgiveness and reconciliation and peace, which are really good and valuable ideas, but they are presented in our Christianity so often in a way that is really about upholding the status quo. You know, we will talk about the cry of the oppressed as a key idea in liberation theology in a minute, but there is no way of maintaining peace in society when there is a cry of the oppressed without stifling that cry. So when we talk about reconciliation, so much of it is about that kind of what Bonhoeffer, the theologian, would call cheap grace, right? It isn't about actually doing the work of reconciling people, but it's just about basically shutting up the oppressed so that we can all have our peace. Yeah, and I think there's that Martin Luther King quote that really summarizes it well about the difference between a peace that is merely the absence of conflict, that I think is exactly what is being looked for. Most Christians' ideas of peace are around conflict aversion, conflict avoidance. And therefore, if you say, well, I'm going to protest, I'm going to put my hand up and say what is happening isn't acceptable, you are the one destroying the peace. And that is, yeah, again, a theological logic that makes it really easy to side with the police, because the police's job is to restore peace and order, which is a Christian ideal.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to link this back to the kind of founding ideologies of our society, you know, not least of which is liberal capitalism. So I guess, you know, you might say that that is the twin ideologies of liberalism and capitalism, which reinforce each other. David Graeber did a lot of good work on trying to get us to understand the violence inherent to capitalism and where that came from and how it's already, it was there from the start. You know, when we're talking about how capitalism was founded, David Graeber says that essentially it started when European powers discovered the Americas and that they had a lot of gold and silver that the Europeans really wanted in order to be able to trade with China. So there's a lot of different ways of thinking about the start of capitalism, but straight away it's founded on violence. And that is what has been handed down to us to this day, and is what the police are fundamentally there to reinforce, and what the state is fundamentally there to reinforce. And so the church working hand in hand with the state quite directly actually reinforces this deeply violent system that has been with us for the last 400 years or so.
And the church's job in that is to make that violence holy.
Yeah, exactly.
The church functions to not just take that violence and distract you from it or take it away, but to shift the blame for causing it onto the protesters, onto the people who simply want a better world, and make the people who are causing the violence, in this case the police, but more broadly the state, and the police act as, you know, the people who have a state monopoly on violence, they become the people working for God. They become holy people meeting out good, divinely mandated violence on the people who would destroy our peace and the Christian order of our society.
Yeah, and actually, it's really important to remember that that's been the case from the outset. You know, when the conquistadors went to the Americas, part of their ideology was to spread the gospel as they saw it. Now, it's not to say that there weren't and haven't always been people operating within the church, you know, the Catholic Church, the Church of England, whatever you may, however you may conceive of it, who have been there calling this out and saying that it's a bad thing, but they've always been minority voices, you know, deeply, you know, very,
yeah,
very few.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, we like to think that we've moved past this. You know, we don't operate in the same sort of directly violent ways that we once did. But actually, you know, two things on that. First of all, a lot of the direct violence that actually happens still globally is explained away, blame shifted to the victim, as we've already seen. We often see that the blame for that violence is shifted to those who are the victims of that violence, or that violence is simply covered up. We just don't see it. We don't know about this violence because it's not shown on the news, it's not shown in newspapers anywhere near as much as it actually occurs. One last thing to say about that is that our understanding of violence is very, very limited. And so we never think really of the violence that is caused by neocolonialism. You know, it's all well and good us talking about, you know, we went off to the Americas and subjugated entire continents and millions of people and so on. But a lot of the reason we don't still do that is because the functions that that served are actually fulfilled through complex economic arrangements by organizations such as the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank.
You're absolutely right to note that the majority of Christian history has been, you know, this pro-colonial, pro-capitalism, pro-violence approach. But as you said, there has always been this minority of Christianity that has opposed that. And so I want to kind of move us on now to thinking a little bit about what resources Christianity offers us to potentially come out in opposition to these forms of violence, to actually be supportive of protest and against the policing of it that descends almost inevitably into violence. And I think I want to start with something we kind of touched on already, which is this Christian notion of justice. What is justice in Christianity?
Yeah, so I think you know, I haven't given this a long drawn out consideration, but I think when we see themes of justice in the Bible and particularly in the Gospels, we are drawing on the idea that God sides with the poor. It's this liberation theology idea of the preferential option for the poor. God is particularly concerned with what happens in communities of marginalized people, because, of course, in liberation theology, poor doesn't just mean those who don't have any money, it means marginalized communities. And actually, you know, that's a principle that you see in Jesus as well, where he talks about you know, what you've done for the least of these, you've done for me. And he doesn't just talk about you know, someone who doesn't have any money. He uses categories to talk about marginalized groups. So I think fundamentally, when we think about justice from a biblical perspective, one of the really important things is how we approach marginalized people and peoples in a society that marginalizes them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, I'd want to center this idea of grace. You know, I did touch on it earlier, but one of the other prime examples of kind of carceral logic within Christianity is the traditional understanding of hell. And obviously that extends out of that theology of the cross that I spoke about, whereby hell is a place of punishment. Hell is prison, right? Hell is just eternal prison where you go, and that allegedly is justice. And actually, if we want to have a understanding of justice within Christianity that, yeah, doesn't suck, we need to center grace within that, and actually the recognition that the point of, you know, justice is not about punishment. It's about grace, and it's about grace-filled communities that learn to live with one another. And I think that's really vital, that actually if your big story of Christianity is ultimately one that involves people getting eternal violence meted out to them, of course you're going to support the temporal violence of, you know, the police beating up protesters. But if we move to a theology that actually centers grace, that says, you know, God is not about punishment, but is about the good of other people, then I think that is, yeah, a much more productive form of theology.
Yeah, and actually, you know, that's a really good point, because one of the key kind of ideas of grace is actually not that it completely disregards the pain, the suffering, the hurt that individuals and you know, broader systems can cause. It's not that we say, well, they've done this thing, but whatever, we don't care about that. It's actually acknowledging what's happened, that actually maybe there has been pain, deep hurt caused by people, but that actually you need to be able to see that for what it is and within the context of what it means to be human, living in a, you know, what we might as Christians call a fallen society. And I don't want anyone to get the wrong idea of what I mean by a fallen society. But you know, the idea that every single one of us sins, and every single one of us is informed and influenced by the societies and cultures and peoples around us.
Yeah, and of course, you know, forgiveness forming that central point of Christianity. You know,
yeah,
we talk about forgive our sins as we forgive others. You know, if you've forgiven someone's sin, then you don't need them to be punished. You know, people sin against you, of course they do, but if we center grace rather than punishment, then that gives us a much more productive base on which to oppose the violence that we see in our society. You mentioned liberation theology, and I think something that's really important is there. You kind of mentioned that one of the central ideas is that God hears the cry of the oppressed. And, you know, protest is the last resort of the oppressed and marginalized people.
Well, actually, not just protest as well. I think, sorry to interject.
Yeah, no.
What I want to make sure we're doing is that we are not just centering the idea of protest, because protest often implies actually a peace in every sense of the word. You know, you might be loud, but you're not, you know, attacking cops or attacking property or being attacked or whatever. But actually, protest and direct action are two different things.
Uh-huh.
And I think we need to recognize that direct action is a deeply important thing that actually is also, and probably more correctly, the last kind of resort of communities that are oppressed.
Yeah. And therefore, we acknowledge that actually God is much more likely to listen to protests and, as you say, direct action than he is to whatever nonsense is going on in Parliament. God does not have ears for MPs. He has ears for the people on the street. And I think that's a really important kind of reminder for liberation theology. And, you know, you're talking about direct action. And again, if we're trying to draw a theology that center some of those ideas, then I think, you know, that story of Jesus trashing the temple, where he goes around and he essentially attacks people for daring to bring commerce into that holy temple space, you know, that's a really good model, because Jesus would definitely have been attacked by the police if he started doing that today.
Well, it's also really important to point out that what Jesus was doing there, first of all, we see quite clearly the day before he did that, well, at least in the Markan account, Jesus actually goes and scopes out the temple,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He turns up, has a look around, and then naffs off, right? And that, to me, I sort of read that and I think, hang on a minute, does he know what he's going to do tomorrow? I think he knows, right?
Yeah.
He's scoping it out, right? And the thing is, the Temple Mount at that time was controlled by a few wealthy sort of priestly families in cahoots with the Roman Empire, right? Jesus knew what he was doing, right? He knew who he was attacking, and it was a deeply anti-imperial assault at the heart of power.
Yeah, absolutely. The final thing I want to talk about Jesus is perhaps a little controversial, but I'm going to do it anyway, which is to draw on Mark 5 and the story of Legion. So Jesus essentially encounters a demon-possessed man. He's possessed by a whole bunch of demons that are apparently called Legion. And eventually Jesus sends Legion into a herd of pigs nearby, and the pigs go mad and throw themselves into the sea. About 2,000 of them do. And on one level, it seems like this really weird story about, you know, Jesus' demon possession. But I think it's really important to recognize that Legion is not an accidental name. You know, Legion is the name of a Roman army unit. And, you know, this is a point in history where there is no distinction between the army and the police. So that Roman army unit is in place to essentially, quote-unquote, keep the peace, in much the same way that people, that the police even at the protests were there to keep the peace. In reality, they were there to use their power, use violence to enforce against marginalized communities. So what we see Jesus doing is essentially telling the army, which is the police, where to go, saying, actually, we don't want you here. You know, ultimately, Jesus knows, in the same way that marginalized and oppressed communities always know, policing is a violent imposition into their community that is working against their welfare. And actually, I think it's so important to reclaim a Jesus that is, to put it bluntly, not here for policing tactics, not here for looking after protests by using your state monopoly of violence. We're talking about a Jesus who is, and I think this is going to be controversial, anti-cop. He throws out the demons that are the people that are policing this community, throws them into pigs, which is the most disgusting and vile animal in this understanding, and those pigs throw themselves in the sea because even they are disgusted by the idea of being that group of people. That's quite a bold and controversial reading of it, but I think that's a really important kind of scriptural place to reclaim an understanding of Christianity that doesn't just support uncritically state violence.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, it may be controversial to say that now, 2,000 years later, and in some respects it was controversial then, but people reading this, Jews reading this, certainly knew what was going on here,
yeah.
Right? This is not controversial in the sense that it's not true. It's controversial in the sense that you're saying something that society doesn't want to hear.
Yeah, this is not a creative reading, and I don't want to, you know, creative readings are cool. Creative reading of scripture is fine, but that's not what I'm engaging in here. This is a very direct reading of scripture on its own kind of argument. This is what that scripture is saying. And I think it's a really good place to start as we work out what to do.
Yeah. And I think I do very quickly, if I may, I think what may be going on in the back of some people's minds as you say this is, well, what about when Jesus heals the centurion's servant and says the centurion has, you know, the most faith of anyone, you know, he's ever come across. And that is a really tricky part. It's not in Mark. It's only in Matthew and Luke. And I think there's a similar one in John. So it's worth mentioning that Mark is the earliest gospel we have. And so this story probably comes from the Q source, which we don't have anymore. But I think the way I've always kind of interpreted this is to say Jesus is dealing with individuals here, right?
Yeah.
So I have good friends who are in the army or in the police even, and are high up in those, relatively high up in those organizations, right? Of course, you know, I don't necessarily share everything with them because that would be stupid. But I still consider them my friends because I've known them for a long time or whatever. And the thing is, the gospel compels us to deal with people where they're at. So it's perfectly possible for someone in that position, like the centurion, to have a great deal of faith, but actually still be wrong and still be working for an imperial power. And Jesus has to deal with him as he meets him. It doesn't say anything of how Jesus really thinks of the power that he's representing. And actually we know from, you know, the example you've just given and countless others that if they'd got down to it, actually Jesus would have something to say about that. And it's worth mentioning that, you know, the people we often think that Jesus, you know, quote unquote, hates the most are the Pharisees, right? But Jesus eats with them. He has discussions with them. Not everything we see Jesus doing is directly attacking everyone who he disagrees with all the time.
Yeah, and I think it's about thinking systematically. I, like you, have friends who are cops, and you know, I think there is a level of individual responsibility, but the problem is not individual. That's a fundamentally liberal reformist approach, a few bad apples or whatever.
Yeah.
We're saying the whole system is the problem, and therefore individuals, okay, fine, you can, you know, make your own moral personal decisions, but it's not about individual choices, it's about the system as a whole.
That's what, and we will talk about this another time, that's what ACAB actually means. You know, the idea all cops are bastards is not actually saying you as an individual human being are a terrible person who's destined to burn in hell for all eternity. It's saying you work for a system that causes everyone who works in that system to reinforce itself, and that system is bad.
So we're running out of time here, so let us end with a quick thought, or maybe on the more practical end, on what Christians and even churches can do as people of faith to work towards a different approach to both protests and direct actions and also policing.
Yeah, well, I think at a fundamental level, be very, very careful about the interactions that you have with the cops and with systems of power. You know, that doesn't mean that you don't interact with them at all. You're kind of forced to. You have to. That's the society, that's the world we live in. But it means that you think very, very carefully about what kinds of interactions you are willing to have with them. So that's a good starting point, I think.
Yeah, and I would say on a corporate church level, thinking about how we pray and who we pray for, we might say we pray for everyone, but we don't ever actually pray for everyone who has the time, but there's something really powerful and important about, you know, who we choose to pray for. And you know what, maybe we shouldn't be praying for police forces, maybe we shouldn't be praying for shallow peace. You know, that's a classic thing that you pray that we might find a way to keep things peaceful, but instead we should be maybe praying, even if it's just that everyone is kept, all the protesters are safe from any form of physical violence that might occur. I understand that people maybe aren't in the place in their churches where they can stand up and pray that the protesters might prevail over the coppers and take over a police station. But we can certainly pray in ways that don't reinforce that the police have the right to be violent or shift the blame onto processors for any violence. And I think that's really important, because that is one of the major ways. And then obviously in the long term, we can look to move ourselves theologically away from forms of theology that presume the need for punishment as the central point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the key is that this is going to be a long, you know, this is a long process. Nothing's going to change overnight. And actually, it's individual battles in a longer war, essentially, is what it is.
And obviously, if you're a person of faith who is, or a person of no faith, if you're a person of any description who is able to safely and securely take part in these actions, then I would absolutely encourage you to do so, even if you are not someone who can necessarily, for whatever reason, be present on the streets themselves. And we know, because of the police violence that happens there, that that isn't an option for everyone. There are ways of supporting these protests and supporting these movements that are really valuable and important as well. So I would definitely encourage people on an individual basis to be involved with this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is all we have time for. Thank you very much, Adam, for joining me today. Adam, where in the world can people find you?
You can find me on various platforms at CommieXIAN.
Cool. You can find us on Facebook.com at facebook.com/breadandrosaries. You can find us on Twitter at bread_rosaries, and you can send us an email at breadandrosaries@gmail.com. We would love to hear people's feedbacks, thoughts, further things they'd like us to chat about, anything like that. We're always very open to hearing that. So Adam, thank you very much for joining me, and we will see you next time out.
See you later.
Get a dose of dirty cold to go, been cold since cold flow. Got a wire to enlarge and I set a fire down below. I hang it up when you say sorry, didn't know. Probably got a year, 10 to go, so let's go. I don't really know how to go slow.
Just got done walking in the snow.
Goddamn, that motherfucker's cold. Hey, you in the wrong mode, you open and close, you know holes, no go. This whole world's a shit mode, built to the brim like Gitmo. When you think it don't get more glow, it limbo to the sticks on flow. All oppression's born of lies, I don't make the rules, I'm just one guy. All due respect of getting spit on, how respect is now defined. Hungry for truth, but you got screwed and drank the Kool-Aid. There's a line, it ends directly at the edge of a mass grave that's their design. Funny fact about a cage, they're never built for just one group. So when that cage is done with them and you still pour it, come for you. The newest, lowest on the totem, well, golly gee, you have been used. You have to build a death machine that down the line will kill you too. Christians, y'all are different. Kids in prisons, they the same shit. Even one scrap of what Jesus taught connected, you'd feel different. What a disingenuous way to piss away existence, I don't get it. I say you lost your goddamn minds if y'all possess one to begin
with. Just got done walking in the snow, goddamn that motherfucker cold. Just got done walking in the snow, goddamn that motherfucker cold. Just got done walking in the snow, goddamn that motherfucker cold. Just got done walking in the snow, goddamn that motherfucker cold. Cold, cold, cold. Run a jewel, we back on our shit, and it's cold as fuck.
The way I see it, you probably free us from the ages 1 to 4. Around the age of 5, you shipped away for your body to be stored. They promise education, but really they give you tests and scores. And they predict in prison population by who's scoring the lowest. And usually the lowest scores, the poorest, and they look like me. And every day on the evening news, they feed your fear for free. And you so numb, you watch the cops choke out a man like me. Until my voice goes from a shriek to whisper, I can't breathe. And you sit there in house on couch and watch it on TV. The most you give is a Twitter rant and call it a tragedy. But truly the travesty, you've been robbed of your empathy. Replaced it with apathy, I wish I could magically fast forward the future so then you can face it and see how fucked up it'll be. I promise I'm honest, they coming for you the day after, they coming for me. I'm reading Chomsky, I'm reading Bukowski, I'm laying low for a week. I said something on behalf of my people and I popped up in WikiLeaks. Thank God that I'm covered, the devil can smother, then you know the evil don't sleep. Dick Gregory told me a couple of secrets before we lay down in his grave. All of us serve the same masters, all of us nothing but slaves. Never forgetting the story of Jesus, the hero was killed by the state.
Just got done walking in the snow, goddamn that motherfucker cold. Just got done walking in the snow, goddamn that motherfucker cold. Just got done walking in the snow, goddamn that motherfucker cold.